Welcome to the Business of Sport, brought to you by Sports Finder. Every week, our CEO, Ahmad El-Hawly, and his co-host, Rob Yowell, founder of Gemini Sport, come together to break down the hottest topics in the world of the business of sport.
Welcome, everyone, to another week of the Business of Sport. We're up to episode 21 now. So time's flying. It's been a roller coaster of fun and great and exciting topics. This week, it's no different. Business as usual, myself, Ahmad El-Hawly, your host, and my co-host, Mr. Rob Yowell. Rob, welcome to the show, buddy. How's things with you?
Well, things are great, my friend. Coming to you from the Mile High City this week. You know, planes, trains, and automobiles, you know, the world of sports. So, but glad to be on with you this week. And like you said, lots of exciting things happening in the world of sport that we'll get to cover in today's episode.
For sure, for sure. And I mean, one country that's really making a lot of noise in the world of sport is Saudi Arabia. And that noise continues to get louder and louder. Saudi Arabia is in major talks to sponsor the new African Super League. So the Guardian reported that the Confederation of African Football is in talks with Saudi Arabia on a $200 million deal to support the new African Super League. This move would pretty much enable the continent to move into the conversation of hosting the FIFA World Cup. The tournament also pretty much, so this is pretty much a breakdown of how that some of that money will be spent. So the tournament plans to offer $100 million in prizes, including $11.6 million for the winner. I mean, that's ridiculous. That's more than five times the top prize for the current CAF Champions League, which is the African Champions League. Saudi Arabia, throwing money at Formula One, throwing money at LIV Golf, throwing money at football, now moving into African football, injecting a life-saving or a league-saving sponsorship. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, first of all, you know, Saudi is still celebrating the Brooks Koepka winning the PGA tournament and and their first major as for a live golfer.
Absolutely.
And they follow it up with again, you know, making a bold move in a continent that has produced, you know, some fantastic soccer talent, and just another way for, you know, their fund to, you know, spread, you know, utilize their financial strength to spread some influence, but at the same time, you know, look, building global sport. And if it, you know, I've had one of my colleagues used to was the CEO of Accra Hearts of Oak, you know, one of the top teams in Ghana. And, you know, there, obviously there's lots of corruption and things like that. But, not, you know, if you find ways to make everybody play on the same level, you know, make it viable for teams to, you know, be successful and generate revenue through successful play, you probably keep some of the African talent home. And more importantly, continue to develop it more. So, you know, look, it's certainly a strong arm play by the Saudis, but it's one, if you're the CAF and the African Super League, you can't turn this down. I mean, this is only allows your league to grow and to you know, continue to have your, you know, your homegrown talent, if you will. Maybe stay home a little bit longer before they get shipped off to a second division team in Europe, or you know, obviously there's some tremendous EPL players, you know, playing at top levels in Serie A and Bundesliga, et cetera. But if you can keep some of those guys a little bit closer to home, or in some cases some of those guys have a reason to come home at the you know, later in their careers, you know, look, it's a win-win all the way around. And again, to your point, you alluded that you know, they got to show that they are capable to host the World Cup on the highest level, and this is this is certainly one way to do it.
Yeah, I think from my understanding of the current landscape, this is a way for Saudi Arabia to further its influence in Africa, a continent that lacks a lot of infrastructure and is ready to be developed. It's the growth corridor of the world moving forward. Many companies, many organizations are looking to grow and expand into Africa. It's one of the only untapped continents, literally, in the world. So what we're seeing here is a play through football, and then I can almost guarantee you it'll lead to more than just investment in football, because Africa is the place to be in the next 15 to 20 years, believe it or not.
Well, you're absolutely right. They've made that move with cricket in India. Here it is. They're making that move with soccer in Africa, and who knows? Maybe you'll see some of the African cricket, in other ways.
The PFL last week with Francis Ngannou. Dana White always talks about the fights in Africa, building a PI center in Africa. So it's the conversation. It really is.
Yeah, it is. They're right at the center of it, and have bank will influence.
Absolutely, awesome. That's all from us in terms of this interesting deal and development. Moving on to our next conversation, closer to home, Super Bowl 60 to be hosted in San Francisco. Wow. The last Super Bowl was hosted there in 2016, which was Super Bowl 50. It generated almost $250 million for the Bay Area economy. Super Bowl 60, coming to the Bay Area, is going to be a very different context to Super Bowl 50, because the streets of downtown San Francisco look very different to what they did back then. And that's not my reporting. That's reporting from multiple reporters on both sides of the aisle. So how do you see this panning out?
Well, the good thing is the Super Bowl's in Santa Clara, not San Francisco.
Oh, there you go.
But to your point, one, I think it will be a strong, the NFL will and the hosting of the Super Bowl will require the entire Bay Area to get its act together as it relates to some of those issues that have been in the public eye lately, certainly as it relates to homelessness and the filth and theft that are going on within downtown. The NFL will have the right to if they feel for any reason that it's not going to be a very good place for them to host. They could, there's numerous venues and cities that would step up at a moment's notice. So maybe it's one of these ways we can see the city of San Francisco and the Bay Area in general, have some motivation to get things in order. Because obviously you mentioned, the financial economic impact of the region is going to be massive. The 49ers have a pretty good team right now. I'm sure that, we've seen the trend, the trends of a couple home teams getting to their home stadium to play in a Super Bowl and win. They certainly are positioned to, realistically consider that as an option. Again, not that sports should be used as a political pawn. We've seen that happen in a couple cases, but hopefully this is a case where this event coming that way will get the city and the respective cities and markets, motivated to put on their best face to they're going to raise a lot of money.
For sure.
Maybe they can get, ahead of the game and solve some of the issues that they have, that are real. But at the same time, if they don't and we don't see the progress, and maybe the NFL is wise enough to, take that game and, take it to another market that's, you know, better prepared, more deserving, and more importantly, you know, they want their fans to have a great experience. You don't want people staying in downtown San Francisco, you know, getting carjacked, stepping in feces, or being accosted by homeless people out in front of their hotel.
Yeah, exactly. So
you don't need that. You don't need that. You don't need that bad press on your, you know, during your biggest week, because obviously it's a it's a huge week of events, you know, leading up to it with NFL experience, all the other activities that go on around that. You have Hall of Fame announcements, if the city's getting on the news for the wrong reasons while you're there, that it keeps people away.
Yeah, I mean, downtown San Francisco will 100% have some sort of input. Yeah, for sure. So, all right, awesome. Let's move on to the NFL draft. It's headed to Green Bay. I mean, this is probably the NFL's smallest market. We know from the draft, the previous numbers have had over 300,000 fans attend. At the NFL's owners meeting last week, they pretty much awarded Green Bay the 2025 NFL draft. The issue is Green Bay's population is pretty much, from different reports, is just above 100,000 people, 110,000 people. So how is Green Bay going to cope with this influx of people? Are they going to build some hotels from now, or what's the go, you reckon?
Well, I mean, look, Milwaukee hotels are probably booking up right now for that. Maybe this is one of the ways that the NFL is trying to help Green Bay out, because they know that they're not going to be they're not going to be viable for the next couple of years with Aaron Rodgers gone and Jordan Love is their new quarterback. But look, there's a lot of history in Green Bay. First two Super Bowls there, title town. There's a lot of history, and this is one of those ways where the NFL can still feature, you know, Green Bay historically with the draft. You know, kind of maybe going back to its roots and its early days. Obviously, you know, winning the first two Super Bowls. I would say that there's going to be some hotel strain. It'll be interesting to see kind of, you know, if people make it the pilgrimage. I think one of the things you'll see the local turnout be extremely strong. Passionate fans throughout Wisconsin. You'll see a lot of, you know, road trips and things of that nature. You probably see campgrounds getting full as well, because they like the outdoors up there too. So I think it'll be a different, unique experience, but also one in a very historic, location that, like I said, you know, sadly and realistically, I don't think anyone is expecting Green Bay to make any noise in the NFL the next couple of years, unless, you know, Jordan Love proves us all wrong and becomes a tremendous, an all-pro quarterback. The NFL has to take care of their smaller markets too.
For sure.
So, and as you mentioned, Green Bay is one of the smallest and the only one without an owner. Maybe this was a time for them to, kind of check that box and take the draft maybe back to a smaller market that could probably really use the boost, in 2025, and we'll see, and they got some time to prepare for it. And again, typically, you've got Milwaukee's a hour drive, so it's not terribly, too far out of the way.
Yeah.
So, because they used to play games down there.
Yeah.
During the regular season. So
I mean,
so
hotels and business owners would be licking their lips. Like,
they're gonna get top rates. That's for sure.
They're going to be making a lot of money, more than what they've probably ever made before. So,
yeah.
Good luck to them. Well done. And we wish them all the best. Staying with football and American football, the XFL season's over. Finished, I think, strong. The final game, the championship game,
between Arlington and DC finished with an average viewership of 1.3 million viewers. So if we compare XFL 2.0 to 3.0, it didn't have the same amount of viewers on TV, but the positive is that he actually finished. XFL didn't finish.
Yeah.
It was cut short. So that was the highest audience since week one, when a few of the games got 1.5 million to 1.6 million viewers. According to ESPN's Vice President of Programming and Acquisitions, Tim Reed, it performed within our expectations. We ended on a high note. So ESPN sounds happy. Over the 10-week season, the XFL averaged 622,000 viewers per game on ESPN, so on and so on. And the 8 games televised by ABC attracted an average audience of 1.13 million viewers. So what we can see there is the free-to-air really brought in some strong numbers. What are your thoughts?
You know, one, finishing on a high note is, you know, certainly a positive. You know, they did have a little glitch in their playoff system with a team like the Battle Hawks, 7-3, not making the playoffs, and Arlington ended up winning the championship with a losing record. You know, a couple of those things. You know, I mean, Battle Hawks, you know, were a good team, and they led the league in attendance. That's probably something they'd like to correct in the future. You know, when they look at it, but again, to your point, they finished the season. Huge upside, obviously. Two, you know, they're seeing the other element that they really wanted to accomplish, and they're seeing players that played in this league getting opportunities in NFL mini camps. So they're seeing that transition of guys getting that second opportunity and making the most of it and seeing their guys get that next chance, you know, to play in the NFL, to showcase their talents. You know, so, you know, again, those are, you know, a lot of those things were, you know, the, you know, some of the guiding principles of why, you know, Danny Garcia and Dwayne Johnson, you know, felt compelled to bring this league back and invest in it the way they have with Redbird Capital. And so, you know, look, I think that there were some exciting games. I thought there were some of the rules were interesting, and I'm curious to see if any of them get, you know, adopted, you know, by some other leagues in ways. And like you said, you know, at the end of the day, you had a great audience watching a game. I think, you know, they had a pretty decent crowd in San Antonio.
22,000
as well. Yeah, 22,000. I mean, so look, that's not too bad. I mean, I would have loved to have seen the Battle Hawks. You know, the Battle Hawks there and see if they travel, you know, for a championship game. I bet you they would have. I bet you would have seen, you know, 30,000-40,000 had they been there, just because, you know, St. Louis fans are great. They're great that way. Like you said, you have over 600,000 viewership on average. You had over a million, 1.1 million average on their NBC or their
ABC
ABC yeah. games, ABC games, and again, finishing on, you know, a high note, really, you know, bookends, you know, a season that showed progress, showed you know, the capability of that we can sustain a second league, and USFL still out there playing, you know, as a third league. So again, you know, we're a football crazed country, the American version, and we'll take any version of it right now, all year round. So
yeah,
I'm curious to see what the USFL wraps up, but again, you know, tip of the cap to XFL for finishing the season, you know, to giving, you know, a lot of those players, you know, a second chance or maybe a third chance to showcase. And for some of them, maybe their only chance that they've got to showcase their skills at the pro level and seeing it, you know, play forward with some opportunities in the NFL are all positives. I can't say that I'd come out of, you know, anything negative of the league, you know, as it, you know, related to, you know, maybe probably the only bad thing was, you know, seeing a team that was playoff worthy, you know, get left out, and the conditions of which the Vegas franchise had to play under with a, you know, less than adequate, you know, playing home field situation. But I think that'll be rectified by next year. And, you know, again, overall, I mean, I give it a, you know, 8.5 out of 10 if you're ranking it.
I have three scenarios / questions for you. Will the USFL and the XFL ever merge?
Maybe. If it makes good business sense.
Okay.
I think you know, I don't know that I don't see us getting into a you know, this full minor league system, double A, single A kind of thing. But I think that if, you know, the, you know, look, right now you've got Fox and, you know, ABC, ESPN, Disney, you know, with spring programming around football right now, that's, you know, generating audience, selling ads,
heavy,
and more importantly,
yeah, heavy, you know, heavy.
Yeah, the public is consuming it right now. And so, you know, you merge, and you know, or is Fox gonna, you know, Fox is obviously invested in the USFL, Disney partnered with the XFL. I don't think that they're going to give up their programming.
Interesting.
At this point. And so, you know, again, it you know, unlike what we saw, you know, the first time around with AAF and USFL and XFL 2.0, you know, they died off for various reasons. You know, money ran out. It wasn't for a lack of interest. That's the thing. It's just that their financing died. COVID, you know, obviously stopped the USFL, you know, last time around. And
killed the, you know, XFL.
And killed, you know, killed the XFL, yeah. And USFL last year kind of relaunched, you know, under the single site model. And, you know, I thought, they did okay. They did enough to where they came back for year two and were able to expand. So,
yeah.
You know, right now the appetite is there for two spring leagues. Like, you know, look, like it or not, watered down or not, there's plenty of guys that still want to play the game and play it at a pro level, and you know, don't have to go up to Canada, don't have to, you know, settle for $250 game checks to play in the Arena League, and
don't have to go to Europe.
Still an opportunity to, yeah, and don't have to go to Europe. Yeah. You know, and again, there's some, you know, some guys, you know, there's some great opportunity in Europe too, but you know, there are guys that want to stay home, and yeah. And this provides an opportunity, and more importantly, that path to, hey, you go show out in that league, you get a call to come to a mini camp.
For sure.
See if you show out against, you know. Yeah. So that first question is maybe. I don't think there's a real yes or no at this point, unless you start seeing one start to falter on a financial standpoint.
Yeah.
But both of them got, you know, strong TV deals. They got good financial backing, and right now the American audience is consuming both and at a level to justify them both being around.
Is it in the best interest of the NFL to sit and watch these guys grow and then acquire?
Interesting. You know, look, the NFL's got the greatest farm system in the world. It's called college football.
Correct.
And now they're getting they've got two leagues that are helping develop late bloomers.
Correct.
Maybe some bounce backs. And look, they're cherry picking the guys. Hey, that guy played well. Hey, maybe there's, like you said, there's some guys that got into some mini camps. Maybe we're last cuts, as The Rock says, you know, number 54. And you know, this is that chance for them. So, you know, do they acquire? Don't know. The NFL is very, very protective of their brand. And really just want to associate with, you know, the Premier League.
Yeah.
But, you know, what you could see down the road is maybe, you know, franchises forming alliances with you know, XFL or USFL teams on, maybe much like a minor league system and saying, hey, you know, you're now funded or affiliated with the Panthers or affiliated with the Packers, affiliated with the Dolphins.
Interesting.
You know, whatever that, yeah. that there might be some way that that happens. But again, I think the NFL and the owners kind of like the deal they have. They're the cat's meow, and everybody wants to get there. There's only so many jobs in the NFL with a 53-man roster for 30 teams. So those are coveted spots, and so I don't think they're looking to fund and finance the minor leagues because college football does it for them without any expense.
Yep.
But I think they will still they will support the growth of the game because yeah, there are going to be some guys that need some more polish, but their playing eligibility's up in the in college. And they can go play us in a spring league and maybe to a point where, we saw guys, have an injury in a spring game, miss their senior year and, but their eligibility's up. And so they go into, they're not going to be in the draft, but they get to play in the XFL and kind of get to play their way back into a mini camp later as an opportunity. I see them keeping a close eye, staying and utilizing those leagues as a farm system in some way to see talent develop and go, okay, I see a guy that I like, give him an opportunity, sign him to a mini camp free agent deal. But whether you're going to start seeing the league take a financial interest, I don't know, but what I could see is franchises kind of creating alliances or affiliations with teams, kind of within their market.
And my last question is, would it be in the best interest of the XFL, obviously from an outsider looking in, or do you think that privatization of these teams would be a good fit for the XFL?
Absolutely. Down the road, we're seeing we're seeing players, former players, that want to get involved in the growth of the game, buying European Football League franchises now, buying Mile High sneezes. But they're getting involved in the sport, but they're not going to be able to get involved as an NFL owner. So what I do see is at some level, you're seeing these professional, former players or maybe players that are still in the league starting to take, some positions in these spring league franchises because it's a great way to develop their skills as a GM or perhaps an owner. And I think the cost of entry is certainly a lot less. So I would think that as you look to expand, and I don't know if expand, but to grow the league, to be able to have ownership that has a little bit of celebrity, panache and notoriety,
some marketing power, could be there. Some marketing push,
marketing power. I mean, look, we've seen it in MLS, with what's happening in Wrexham. They've turned a fifth division club, and made it a global, globally popular club.
Crazy.
LAFC has a lot of celebrity ownership. We're seeing it crossover in some other sports. NFL is one where Magic Johnson being part of this Commanders relationship is, probably the, but Magic's involved in, three different, pro sports franchises as a minority owner now. So, but I think that, as the league grows, as XFL grows and Redbird Capital, they're not in this to keep sinking money into it. They're in this for a profit.
Exactly.
So the way you're going to start seeing that profit is, you got to, first of all, you got to show that these teams are sustainable in their market by themselves year round. You know, so year two for them, you know, where they did the, hey, we're all practicing in one city, and then we kind of jump out to the, you know, to the, quote, home cities, home markets. This is going to have to eventually, you know, drop into Houston in the spring and, you know, Memphis in the spring and be able to sustain, you know, a team with ticket sales, with marketing, with sponsorship around the team. So, you know, that's really going to be the true test before you're going to say you're going to be able to, you know, put a $50 million, $100 million franchise valuation on one of these franchises and start to reach out to prospective owners. And again, you know, you start, look, we just saw an MLS franchise sell for $500 million. So you know, the reality is we're a football country. You know, so $50 to $100 million for a successful XFL or even a USFL franchise maybe is not that far off if that's the, you know, that's where this profit will really turn. But you've got to prove that they're all standalones in those markets. And that's the question that I think that we'll all have, especially for those teams that are in NFL markets, right? So, you know, a Houston, you know, there was three Houston franchises, for crying out loud. Is that reality? I mean, obviously, a San Antonio is not an NFL market. You know, does Oakland now get a team, you know, in the future? It'll be quite interesting to see. But I do believe, you know, XFL and with Redbird Capital kind of in the, you know, in a driver's seat, I think you see them make a move to putting franchises out because they've already kind of taken the step of we're playing in home markets. USFL has not done that yet. They've kind of done the pod system, but I think in all the cases, you know, the proof is really going to need to be there to sustain itself in operations of a full staff, you know, venue operations, ticket sales, and players living in the markets, you know. So, you know, that'll be the true test. And look, I hope to see it grow because again, I'm a fan of the game. I think it's been great to have, you know, football in the spring, and we're seeing, you know, lots of opportunity for players to play and to continue play and for some, you know, get that NFL dream, you know, that dream call answered. So,
wow.
It's certainly something to watch closely. And obviously, you know, you can run the numbers you know, if you're selling it at, you know, at just $20 million. I mean, it'd be a significant return given to what they paid for the rights.
For sure. I mean, from what I heard, some USL teams are selling some ridiculous figures. So, imagine a team that's attracting over 1 million viewers a week and in a big competition like this and with America's biggest sport. So they're definitely worth a ton of money if they can just show that these teams are around to stay for a long time.
That's the deal. And I think, you know, we'll be going into year two and three of these leagues, you know, as we come into next year. So I think USFL probably, you know, has a chance to, you know, to really show some sustainability by moving into markets next year. And I think XFL will make that move into markets next year as well. So I think, you know, this next season will be very big for them in order to, you know, show that, that capability and then really be able to turn around and start putting franchises up for sale. And I think if they do it, they got to do it, you know, on a wholesale, you know, not piecemeal, not sell them one at a time, but I think really be aggressive and say, look, we've got 10 franchises. We want to find 10 owners. And if we don't find 10 owners, we'll operate as a single entity league until we have them all sold, you know, kind of thing, so that everybody is on, you know, so we're not playing a league run team versus a team run by, you know, owned by a, you know, a billionaire that spends differently. Kind of thing.
Yeah, so you know, makes a lot more sense.
All right, we're staying on football. You mentioned college football a fair bit. There's been some news out of the world of college football and EA Sports. We're finally going to have a college football game expected to launch in 2024. We haven't had a game in about 11 years. Players will be pretty much paid, those that opt in, through EA's deal with a group licensing firm, One Team Partners, who are absolutely dominating at this time. One Team are growing at a rapid pace and doing very, very well. I mean, with all the NIL movement happening, and you know, this is another opportunity for athletes to monetize their name, image, and likeness. The question is, how much will they monetize? Are we going to see another deal like the one that happened with Fanatics, where they were making something like $5 to $10 a jersey, if that? Or is this one a bit more significant? So, because you have more than 120 schools that have committed to actually being featured in the upcoming game, and that includes all the major conferences and also the college football playoff. What are your thoughts?
Well, one, you know, the EA college football game was one of the most popular, video games out there when EA, simply pulled it down, 11 years ago, following the O'Bannon ruling, and just, it was one of those clear and obvious, we're using the name and image and likeness of players. And now that it's returned, in an era of NIL, it's great to have the game back. Two, it's great that the players can, openly participate. They can opt in for their image rights to be used and be compensated for it. And that's great. And again, I think that's the way it should be. As we've been talking about football for the past 25 minutes of the segment, football is the dominating sport in America. So, again, give it to us any way we can get it. And this is a game that's tremendously popular. There's a generation here, a generation of young fans that probably still go back and play the college football games, from the past, and now they get to utilize the guys they're watching play now. I think it'll be good. I think it'll be popular. I mean, certainly, could be a lot of marketing behind it. So I expect to see EA, spending a lot around college football this fall and to push the game and getting out into the college market and doing stuff around tailgating and getting into on campus to, get the student bodies engaged. So I think it'll be fun. I think it'll be something that we'll get back up to speed very quickly. And certainly, it was a big moneymaker for EA when it was going 11 years ago. I think it will be again.
Absolutely, definitely. There's tens of thousands of college athletes and college students waiting, and millions of alumni waiting too. So it's
I guess one of the question is, will we have the Madden curse for the college game? There was always whoever was on it the year it came out always tended to get hurt or have a bad season. So I'm wondering if there will be college athletes that will kind of turn down the opportunity to be the cover guy for the game fearing the jinx.
Anything's possible in 2023, my friend.
That's right. But, the NIL money may be too much for them to turn down. Who knows?
Let's wait and find out. Tom Brady is looking to invest in the Raiders, and he's getting ever, ever closer. The owner of the Las Vegas Raiders, Mark Davis, has accepted his bid. Now we're going to get pushed forward to the owners of the teams. And
this will pretty much put an end to all the speculation around him coming back, because it's, if you're an owner, you need a special exemption from the league and the team owners to be an owner and a player. And I don't think anybody's going to agree to giving their rival a competitive advantage. So it just doesn't make sense. I think he can move into his Fox job as a media commentator. It's $375 million 10-year deal, and sail off into the sunset and watch the Raiders every week.
Yeah, well, safe to say that Fox will have to avoid putting him on a rare game in the event that they have one, unless it's the Super Bowl. So, we've seen Tom, you know, already invest in the Vegas market with the Aces, you know, which also is owned by Mark Davis. So there's already an existing relationship there. We know that he had expressed interest in team ownership before. And again, as we talked about, I mean, it's a significant, commitment to even on a minority level. Tom has had an extremely successful business and playing career. And obviously he's got his good friend and longtime offensive coordinator, Josh McDaniels, their head, coaching it now. So will he be an owner / volunteer coach here in the future? I mean, maybe we're seeing that for the first time. Look, we've seen Jerry Jones play general manager, but I don't think we've seen someone come out of the owner's box and actually coach a little bit. And maybe Tom Brady can coach Jimmy Garoppolo, his old backup, up a little bit this year too.
Yep, could be. Anything's a possibility. Now we move to a different football, the world game. This is a really interesting story, actually, which is why I really wanted to talk about these guys. Brighton Albion. I mean, this is a team that played in the championship at one stage. They were promoted to the Premier League. They're going to finish in the top six this year. They've become the talent factory of Europe. They're sending talent all over Europe and to all the big teams in the Premier League. And for the first time in their 121-year history, Brighton Albion will play European football next season, whether it's in the UEFA Europa League or the UEFA Europa Conference League. So this is unbelievable. If for those that know who Brighton Albion is, this is a major, major, major achievement.
Well, absolutely. I mean, it's a the world game continues to give us fantastic stories that are of some of the little guy succeeding against the well-heeled and well-funded organizations. And this is just another one of those, great underdog stories of a club, that scraps and claws and gets its way up into the Premier League. And as you talk about the financial impact of what it means for these clubs to perform at that level and to get into the Premiership, we've seen those celebrations just even in the lower levels of as they move up, what it means to a community. And again, the financial impact is going to be massive, and one for, a club of this stature, it's a big deal, overall big deal for them to get up and stay up and compete, against in arguably the best league in the world. To compete, so it's commendable, and look, we all love the underdog story.
Absolutely, and last but not least, we move to our last talking point. The Fanatic spending spree continues. They've just acquired another company, PWCC. PWCC is an auction, a buying collectibles auction company. The sum was not disclosed, but this pretty much tops what they purchased last year, which is a company called Topps for $500 million in January 2022. This really positions Fanatics in a very strong position, because now they're moving in on the whole collectible scene. And I mean, for anyone who watches Netflix, I'm sure they've seen the Netflix series called the Golden Touch. And he's and the founder of Golden is Ken Golden, and he actually made an interesting comment about this. He said, "I think that the sports collectible business, Fanatics, is going to have the biggest impact." So we're hearing this from somebody who's been in this his whole life, and he's built something from scratch, and he's got a Netflix series about him that's going crazy worldwide. It's top 10 in Australia. It's absolutely blowing up. So again, the Fanatics team, the Fanatics train continues. We're seeing this push for dominance in the sporting world, and they're making some major moves. Every month, something new is popping up.
Well, look, you know, Fanatics is, you know, this is one of those things in the sports business world, is that, you know, the last two years of this company should just be something to be followed in sports business. I mean, the path that they've carved out, you know, as a what everybody, you know, we all saw them as one of the strongest, you know, merchandising and apparel partners in the sports business, and how they've really evolved, you know, into, you know, went down the path with NFTs, got into the gambling gaming business, and you know, and obviously have, you know, advanced into the collectible business, you know, memorabilia, they have, you know, become a behemoth, and I think we talked about it a few episodes ago. They've gone to, you know, they've become you know, the new jersey supplier of the NHL. You know, from being the guys that were selling the t-shirts to the guys that were, you know, that are providing the uniform. It's been a pretty incredible, you know, just evolution of a company,
yeah,
of this time. And you know, it's and look, it's, they've all been very strategic, been smart. They've all made sense. And given that they, you know, their connectivity and their reach that they built through their merchandising partnerships with all of the leagues, they have, you know, they're in a great position to connect, contact, and conduct business with, you know, a massive, you know, Rolodex of customers across all levels of sport. You know, knowing that it, and you notice they've picked very successful strategic niches in the game, gambling, you know, memorabilia, merchandise, and so, you know, they kind of stayed really in their lane. But they've gotten into ones that are very similar and complement what their core business has been. And look, you know, it's been a model, you know, model growth of a company from being a, you know, like I said, being an online t-shirt store to boom being, you know, really one of the biggest players in sports, college, pro, et cetera, you know, in the last 2 years. Just really has been incredible to watch.
Yeah, Michael Rubin's on a mission, and we wish him all the best with it, my man. You keep this team train going.
Yeah, absolutely. Keep giving us stuff to talk about, Michael.
Absolutely. And that pretty much brings us to the end of our segment. And as always, I give you parting words, my man.
Well, since I'm in Denver right now, I will. This will be a little bit of the tip of the cap to Stan Kroenke. What a run he has had with the teams that he owns. He owned the Los Angeles Rams, won a Super Bowl 2 years ago. He owns the Colorado Avalanche. They won the Stanley Cup last year. He owns the Colorado Mammoth. They won the NLL championship last year and are playing for the championship again this year. He owns Arsenal, which has finished second in the Premier League and qualified for the Champions League for the first time in, you know, 5 years. And he just so happens to own the Denver Nuggets, who just swept the Los Angeles Lakers out of the Western Conference Finals And Stan Kroenke is playing for another trophy starting June 1st with the NBA title. So, you know, that doesn't happen very often, that a man that owns that many franchises has that level of success in that succession. And I think a lot of it starts with, you know, not only his commitment to his teams, but the leadership and the organizational management that he has around his franchises. And, you know, it's just, you can't just sit, you know, on the byline and just go, that's chance. There's something there. And so all you got to do in the world of sports is you just tip the cap to the guy and go, job well done, sir. You know, model organizations, you know, are something to be admired. And he's got one hell of a run going here. So if he's got any lottery numbers he'd like to share with you and me, I'll take them, because clearly he's got something figured out, and good for him.
There you go, ladies and gentlemen. You know, thank you all very much for tuning in. Thank you, Rob, again. Another week, another great episode with you. Time well spent, lots of nuggets. Take care, everyone. We'll catch you all next week.
All right. Thank you, my man. Be good.
Take care.
Thanks for listening to the Sports Finder podcast. Subscribe to our show for the latest episodes on Spotify and Apple Podcasts. And for more information, check out our website at sportsfinder.com.